This is News and Notes. I'm Ed Gordon. On today's roundtable, the chairman of ExxonMobil says he sympathizes with consumers, but... And the so-called 20th hijacker learns his fate. Joining us today from our New York bureau, Walter Fields. He's CEO and publisher of the NorthStarNetwork.com, and Pedro Noguera, professor of education at New York University. Also with us, economist and author Julianne Malveaux. She joins us from our NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. All right, folks, thanks very much for joining us. Let's get right into the fate of Zacharias Moussaoui, which we learned yesterday, life in prison. Some people surprised, but Pedro, others will suggest that... The Justice Department prosecutors really did not have the case to put this man to death. Even some of the victim's relatives had suggested that this is a minor player, a wannabe who's looking for headlines.
I think that's exactly right. I think that, not only did they make the case that he was, in fact, one of the conspirators, but the real question is, why was it that the FBI wasn't able to extract information from him that could have been used to prevent 9/11? That's the real case here. That's who should be on trial, actually, is the FBI, and why they bungled this whole thing, as Moussaoui, as the man put on stand, shows. To have him in jail for the rest of his life is clearly no light punishment. And I think that the real question is, why aren't we looking at some of the larger issues surrounding this case?
Walter Fields, the interesting point that I heard from, again, some of the victims' relatives is they believe that there are others who have a closer connection to 9/11 who are already in custody of the federal government who have not been put on trial yet.
Well, I think, you know, the jurors certainly didn't believe the government's argument. Particularly, I don't think they believed the fact that had they known earlier that the government would have been able to stop the attacks. I mean, I think there was a credibility issue on the part of the government. Also, you have to also remember that imposing the death penalty is a heavy burden upon an individual. And I think, you know, you're looking at people who are making this decision. And I think given the evidence before them, they didn't feel comfortable imposing that sentence upon Moussaoui. That doesn't mean that they don't believe that he had some culpability in the September 11th events, but I don't think it rose to the standard that the government attempted to impose in this case. So I think the jurors made a reasoned decision when they imposed a life sentence.
Here's the interesting point, too, Julianne Malveaux, when Walter brings up the idea, had the government known, they might have been able to prevent this. People forget that this kind of chatter, even the idea of the use of planes flying in the building, had been heard by government officials.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the flying schools where one of the actual terrorists was enrolled alerted the FBI to the fact that there was something just a little fishy about this man's participation in the flying school, the type of plane he wanted to fly and everything else, and they never followed up on it. The fact is the CIA and the FBI combined are the gang that couldn't shoot straight. Even if this man had given them a roadmap, they probably wouldn't have believed him. So I think the jury was absolutely right to... Essentially, he has culpability. He clearly is a terrorist. Let him rot in jail. This man wanted to be a martyr in any case, and I think that that's something that should be denied. Send him someplace, give him like, you know, a liter of water and a Bible every day, and, you know, just leave it alone. So I think the jury did the right thing, but I think more importantly, as Walter says, there are some real issues here. We can go back and look at the 9/11 report that Congress put out or so many other things. Our so-called security agencies never provided us with security.
We should note that Moussaoui will be incarcerated, solitary confinement, 23 hours out of the day, allowed out for 1 hour of exercise, no human contact, as they call it. So it will not be an easy existence for him, but he will not be put to death. One other thing, Pedro, that one of the victim's relatives suggested, and I often wonder about this as America looks at the whole question of finding Osama bin Laden, bringing him to justice, the idea that we have yet to find him. If we remember the famous bullhorn speech by the president, one would have believed with all of America's might, military strength, intelligence, that we would have found this man by now. Does it matter that we haven't?
I think absolutely it does. Osama bin Laden is the recognized leader of Al-Qaeda, and that movement is very active throughout the world. And the fact is that it is remarkable that the United States hasn't been able to pinpoint his location and capture him at this time. And the fact that we can't, I think, speaks volumes to the misplaced priorities and the misleadership in Washington.
Pat, but do we want to find him? I mean, here's the issue. Do we really want to find Osama bin Laden? I mean, I think, you know, we created him. We have had relationships with many of these terrorists like Saddam Hussein and others. I don't think we want to find him. I don't think the resources have been put into doing that. That's why if we found Osama bin Laden, that will be rejection to our presence in Iraq. I don't think this administration has the slightest interest in tracking this man down.
Walter, I don't want to get too legal in the aspect of the Massawi case, but here's something interesting. There were mitigating factors, if you will, that weigh in as to whether or not someone should be put to death. It's found that three jurors found one of the mitigating factors to be that Massawi had been the subject of racism in France as a Muslim youth. This is interesting because often when people try to bring this up in the United States when it comes to African Americans and others, that is oftentimes rejected as a legal defense.
Well, it's interesting in the context of sort of a global outlook that perhaps individual jurors looked at an international context and talking about sentiments towards the United States, you know, growing up in France. And I think, you know, the jury, we talk about the jury as a collective body, but these are individuals who are listening to testimony and making decisions based upon their own personal feelings towards issues. They're supposed to be objective, but there's a lot of subjectivity brought into a juror's thinking when making this decision. So I think those mitigating factors were important to some of those jurors, and they certainly showed it by the sentence that they imposed.
All right. Let's move our attention. And Julianne, I'll ask you, as I do often, to put your economist hat on and take a look at the idea of gas prices continuing to rise. The Today Show this week asked a number of the heads of the oil companies to come on and speak and talk to the landscape. The only one who accepted the invitation was Rex Tillerson, who's head of ExxonMobil, the chairman there. And he talked about the landscape and how the idea of gas prices, he understood, are in fact causing difficulties for people. But he said the alternative of no gas or longer lines isn't attractive either. How much do you buy that's real?
Well, it's it's corporate spin. It's not, you know, their profits are at an all-time high. They're not hurting, and the American people are. The average middle-class household has about a 1% or 2% effect from these increased gas prices, and people are making discretionary decisions about whether they will, you know, go on vacation because of the price of gas. And I don't know anywhere where it's less than $3, and in some cases it's around $3.50. So we're really looking at very high gas prices, and he has to say, you know, gee, I'm concerned about this, but the fact is that I saw his interview, and it was very interesting because he said the gas companies don't collude. Well, they never formally collude, but Ed, isn't it always interesting that just as we start getting close to Memorial Day, we see, which is Memorial Day to Labor Day is a key, you know, driving period in the United States, we start to see the prices going up.
And somehow those prices go up.
And mark my words, they will probably spike again a little bit somewhere around the 4th of July. And this is just a pattern. It happens all the time. So you don't have to have a meeting and say, all in favor of raising gas prices, please signify by saying aye. All you have to do is have, you know, the pattern and practice of having done this. So I reject the notion of non-collusion.
Yeah. Pedro, here's what was really interesting to me in the interview. Matt Lauer, at the end of the interview, asked whether or not he would, being Tillerson, think of the idea of just taking less profit and giving ease to the American consumer. And he said, in spite of corporate spin, hey, we're in this game to make a profit. We have to answer to our shareholders. And essentially saying, that's what this is about for us.
Well, and I think that honesty speaks volumes to where we stand and why we're in this mess we are now, because the Bush administration is very connected to the oil industry. They have been the major supporters of that administration, Vice President Cheney particularly. And the fact that we have an administration that has supported those policies and refused to regulate that industry and at the same time refused to call for conservation and serious alternatives to petroleum, I think all creates a dynamic where our dependence on oil creates a financial crisis that will only deepen. The fact is that our country, unless we still has very cheap gasoline prices compared to most countries, and we have not yet begun to address how the ways in which ordinary Americans are implicated in this crisis with their love of SUVs and high fuel vehicles.
And lest we forget, Walter Fields, the auto industry in all of this, one of the things, again, being a native Detroiter, that has been talked about time and time and time again is the idea of making a more fuel-efficient vehicle, and whether or not the United States consumer wants that. Certainly, we had this boom in SUV and big trucks, etc. But there is also the question of whether or not a happy medium can be reached by the auto industry, and perhaps they did not go down that road to find a more fuel-efficient car that still had a little power to it.
Well, look, there's enough guilt in all parties. I think the oil industry is certainly making money hand over foot, but I think you also have to look at the government's responsibility, and you have to look at the American consumer. I mean, as Pedro indicated, the fact of the matter is that we have been so thirsty for oil. I mean, it's not just the automobile. When you look at air travel, the fact that the airline industry is hurting, the fact that, you know, trucking industry, all across the board, we consume so much energy and we waste so much energy. So I think the auto industry has taken some steps. I mean, you're beginning to see more hybrid automobiles being put on the market. But the problem really comes down to how much we consume, how much the government will regulate this industry that's making so much money. The one quarter profits for the top four oil companies were greater than the profits for some of the largest corporations over a year. I mean, that's crazy. So the notion that, you know, this corporation can't do more in terms of giving a little bit back to the consumer, you know, is absolutely ridiculous. But I think when we look at this issue, it really comes down to this notion of consumption, and this country doesn't have an energy policy.
You know, Julianne, are we in danger, pick up on your point, but are we in danger of a kind of the emperor has no clothes, not really looking at the situation? Walter talks about the airline industry, the automobile industry. When you do look across the waters and look at what others pay for gas, aren't we really in danger of a true shock to the system, perhaps even 5-10 years down the road?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, with the increasing consumption power that China has, they're demanding more of the world's oil supply. With our hostility to Venezuela and Bolivia and Brazil, where we have significant amounts of oil in Latin America, we end up literally isolating ourselves in the face of this addiction, I think, that Walter talked about. As you say, it's the emperor has no clothes. We had a shock in the, I believe it was like 73, 74. Remember those long long gasoline lines that we had in the Northeast. We had a shock then, and the response was to push Detroit on fuel efficiency, to do some things with regulation, and then we just sort of, everybody got happy again. The one thing that we haven't done that we really must do, and
the
we
argument
must look
though,
at,
Julianne, was that OPEC was a much stronger union at that point. Do you believe that?
That's probably the case, but the fact is that we don't produce enough oil that meets our needs, so we're politically vulnerable if anyone else in the world is producing our oil. So although OPEC's strength may have waned, we have had interesting relationships with Nigeria, sort of a deteriorating relationship with Venezuela. As opposed to the 70s, now we have the increased pressure on world markets from China, which is rapidly moving into industrialization. So the OPEC argument, Ed, is strong, but that doesn't stand on its own. But the point I want to make is that the federal government has failed. We've implicitly subsidized gasoline consumption and highways, but we failed to look at alternative modes of transportation. And I just think about the way the feds have starved Amtrak. I mean, if people have alternatives that are efficient, mass transportation alternatives, if you go to most of our major cities, you have poor forms of mass transit. And that's our major cities. Let's not even go to second tier cities. And so we could really do a lot more to do alternative forms of transportation, which would take the pressure off of our demand for oil.
Right. We'll continue to watch this. I want to leave us enough time. We'd be remiss in not talking about this man. I think when we talk about looking for role models and good parenting role models specifically, of course, the world heard of the death of Earl Woods yesterday, Tiger Woods' father. And Pedro, it was just nice to be able to see a true friendship between parent and child. And this was personified in no better way than what we saw the relationship between Earl Woods and Tiger.
No, it's true. And Tiger, I think, has been such a role model for so many young people who would never consider golf as a sport, but simply because of its association with elitism in this country. The fact that his father played such a role in cultivating his interest and supporting him, I think, is also a real important message out there to fathers throughout this country, particularly black fathers.
Yeah, Walter, and he did it in such the right way, if you'll allow that. The idea that he pushed him but didn't push him too far. He even went on to say, Earl would say, look, I wanted him to be great. I wanted to push him, but Tiger was the one who really pushed this. I would say to him sometimes, hey, take it easy. Enjoy life.
Well, I think the most important thing that I ever heard Earl would say was that he was trying to raise his son to be a good person. He wasn't trying to raise him to be a golf champion. And I think if you try to raise your children to be good people, they'll accomplish a lot in life. I think you get into trouble when you try to raise your child to be a celebrity. You know, I think Earl Woods did an incredible job, as did Tiger's mom, in raising a son who obviously just, you know, adores both of his parents. And certainly, you know, our thoughts and sympathy go out to him, because it's tough when you lose a parent at any time. But when you're in the spotlight, it can become even more tough, because they were constant companions, you know, through all those golf tournaments. So I know he's feeling it today.
Hey, Julianne, one of the interesting points, too, is the idea of it takes a big man to allow your son to grow past you. Even though we say we want our children to achieve, we want them to become successful, particularly when you prime them, and you know sometimes that they've outgrown your tutelage.
Yeah, it's an interesting. Earl Woods was clearly a great man, and raised a great son, and had the sort of equanimity to just basically take everything that came up, and just it didn't give either of them a big head. One of the things that I think is most interesting about him is how he said some years ago that when he raised Tiger, he wanted to avoid some of the mistakes that he'd made when he raised his first set of kids, and it really does raise questions about roles of fatherhood or models of fatherhood. And so many men believe that being a good father simply means providing. And certainly providing is very important. But the issue, the role of masculinity is often that you don't spend time with your kids because you're too busy, or you spend very little time with them. And that was just a model of how, you know, a man took a boy and molded him. So it really, and as you said, did not mind the fact that he'd been eclipsed. In fact, took great pride in it. They took great pride in each other. It was just a joy and a treat at a time, as you say, when African-American men are not often celebrated for their fatherhood, to watch the two of them together.
Well, as Walter said, we send our sympathies to the family and salute that family to show us all what family can be about. Walter Fields, Pedro Noguera, Julianne Melville, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
You.